Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. In this episode, we feature two interviews conducted by Cliff Anderson, the Director of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Library. Cliff is a librarian and a leader here in Vanderbilt's digital humanities efforts, and he's always bringing to my attention powerful new tools for scholarship and teaching. Both of his interviews focus on one such tool, called Neo4j, an open-source platform that can be used to visualize and analyze data and connections among data. Cliff interviews his Vanderbilt Library colleague, Sue Ellen Stringer High, who has an awesome job title, Linked Data and Semantic Web Coordinator. Sue Ellen has worked with a number of faculty members and students here at Vanderbilt, helping them use Neo4j in their research. In the interview, she talks about some of those projects and how a database tool like Neo4j can be easier to use than one might think. In the second interview, Cliff interviews Michael Hunger, who handles developer relations for Neo Technology, the company that developed Neo4j. Michael shares a few more examples of how Neo4j has been used, including, as I learned listening to the interview, in the analysis of the Panama Papers, a set of 11 million financial documents leaked earlier this year. First, however, Cliff talks with Sue Ellen Stringer High here at Vanderbilt about Neo4j and about the kinds of graphs that it uses to make sense of data.
Hi, this is Cliff Anderson, and I'm here for the Leading Lines podcast. I'm the Director for Scholarly Communications in the Vanderbilt University Library, and I also work across the campus with our friends in supporting education technologies in various fields. So I'm here today with Sue Ellen Stringer High, who is our coordinator for linked data in the semantic web in the Vanderbilt University Library. Good morning, Sue Ellen.
Hi, Cliff.
So just want to ask you some of your some questions about the way in which you've been using graphs in particular to teach students and how that fits into our overall education and technology program. But before we get there, why don't we just start with, you know, sort of introducing who you are and how you got to the point where you are in librarianship.
Okay, great. My name is Sue Ellen Stringer High, as you said, and I've been working in the Heard Library now for about 20 years. I started off working in special collections, and then when the new online catalog was coming on, that was Acorn way back when, I started getting interested in technology, and so I started working with that wing of the library. It was at that time called Library Information Technology Services. And so worked for many years doing web development and support for various of the services that the library provides electronically. And so when Cliff came on board for the scholarly communications team, it opened up a window for me to do what I've been interested in a long time, which was work on linked data and the semantic web.
Yeah, in fact, I think we might mention that the way that I discovered your interest was reading some articles you had written on a subject called topic maps, which were a really interesting technology that never really took off, but thinking about how to model objects and relationships using graphs in XML.
Yeah, it was it was probably the background that gave me I had become fascinated by going to some XML conferences and meeting some people there who were developing XTM, which was that stands for XML for topic maps. And that was developed out of some people who were working on back of the book indexes, and they were trying to come up with an XML serialization that would allow them to do those the kinds of things you do within back of the book indexes electronically. I mean, electronically or digitally. And it was really fascinating. It just, for various different reasons, never really took off. RDF sort of supplanted it in a lot of ways. But it did give me the background to understand how valuable it can be to use graphs for various educational technologies.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. I think one of the interesting things about graphs in particular is that they're really everywhere. So, you know, in thinking about the use of graphs as an education technology, we should think, first, I think we should probably put a caveat, and you can make this point better than I, that we're not talking about bars and charts here. We're talking about something else.
Right. We're kind of talking about what's essentially a mathematical graph, which means it has a lot of nodes and edges. And basically, and back to the topic map model, you have topics or objects and then relationships between those. And the reason that that is so useful in terms of modeling information is that in the past, we used to have to model information with embedded relationships because we could use hierarchies, but we never really could code the interconnections between things. And I often say it's a lot like in the old days when you'd go to the card catalog and you'd get a see also reference. In order to, find that see also reference, you kind of had to pick yourself up and walk over to the other place where that was. And this is just a way to, code those relationships so that we can do various things with them.
So what I think is interesting is once you start thinking along the lines of a graph model, you begin to think that you begin to see that lots and lots of things that we encounter in our daily life can be modeled easily as graphs. And so I think that's sort of where it comes in for an education technology. This is a technology that runs the gamut. It's used modeling as graphs, used very heavily in the natural sciences, also in the social sciences for things like network analysis, but also in particular in the digital humanities. And I think that might be an interesting place to start, because you've been teaching several workshops and in other contexts where you teach people to apply graphs to what are classical humanities problems.
Yes, we have used graphs to analyze things like, an example of one that we did was we took a corpus of letters from Flannery O'Connor that we have at the library, and then we reached out to some other libraries to get some metadata about the letters that they have. And then we were able to encode that and create some of the relationships between the dates and the subjects and who she wrote to and things like that. And in by creating that particular graph, we were then able to ask questions of it that would have been much harder without that particular way of going about it.
So tell me a little bit about the tools that you're using to do this kind of encoding it as a graph.
We have been using a tool called Neo4j, which is a NoSQL database, which just means it stores the data in graph format with the nodes and edges. And there's several ways that you can use Neo4j. One is as a large-scale database. You can upload Excel spreadsheets into it and then do some networks analysis on it. Neo4j has lots of different levels that you can work with, and so it's really useful. But one of the things that we have found most useful in teaching is something called a graph gist. And the graph gist was created by Neo4j just to get people to be able to try out what it means to encode information in a graph and then be able to query it. And it's very simple. It's very easy to work with. And I found that humanities scholars, it's just very intuitive to them. They can understand, and that a lot of the problems that they're interested in and want to research lend themselves well to graph format. And then on top of that, they don't need a programmer to kind of begin to work with this tool. So it's really helpful in a lot of different ways.
So I think one of the things that's really interesting about Neo4j is the query language Cypher. And what's nice about Cypher is that it uses a kind of visual programming style. So based on ASCII art syntax, basically you know, you model a node with two parens surrounding the node, and a relationship looks like a dash with a caret pointing to the right. And I think what one of the things that's nice when you're teaching humanists who may never have programmed before is that the syntax is very intuitive, and they seem to grasp it very quickly.
Yeah, it's actually fun to work with. I've had a lot of people say they really actually, you know, kind of enjoy doing that kind of coding because, like you say, it's very intuitive and it's visual, and it's just really interesting.
So can you tell us about some of the other Neo4j projects that you've worked on?
Well, I've done a little bit with working with some short stories. Two short stories come to mind. One was a Flannery O'Connor short story called The Life You Say May Be Your Own. And then I also published an article that used a graph to illustrate some points about a Vladimir Nabokov short story called The Vain Sisters. And it was the type of thing that lent itself very well to a graph because it operates on several levels. And I was able to use the graph to point to some outside references or resources that it was fairly clear that Nabokov used to illuminate the story. And so the graph allowed me to do things that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do as easily with expository writing.
I think the Nabokov example is particularly interesting because, as I understand from you, his stories, at least some of them, are not self-contained. They actually make references to things in the external world that are very useful to shed light on what he's talking about, so that being able to model his story as a graph and be able to point beyond the story and then reach back into it is actually an important form of literary analysis for Nabokov.
Very, very true, yes.
So what are some of the hardest things for humanities students coming to grasp for the first time? Where do you see them having the hardest time?
I think the hardest time for them is getting over the idea that they can't code or that they're not coders or they're not programmers or that, you know, that's just not their thing. Once they get past that, they seem to be able to very easily do the data modeling, which is necessary because that's just kind of the way they're used to thinking about things. And it's a lot like, you know, those brainstorming bubbles when you're trying to decide what you want to write a paper about or whatever. You just draw a bunch of circles and then the connections between those. And when you get done with it, you kind of go, aha, I know what I want to write. And the process is very similar when you're doing data modeling for use with graph analysis. So that part is not a problem. The only real problem is the idea that, you know, I don't know how to do this. This is, you know, a huge steep learning curve. And I think once they get over the fear of it, they really take to it pretty easily.
And we should also mention that you regularly teach workshops. You'll be teaching a workshop in the fall on Neo4j and probably likely at that camp. And you've also recently published a article on the library website about getting started with Neo4j.
Yes, I put up a little tutorial. It's under our workshops, and I think it's called Getting Started with Graph Gists. And I walk you through the steps that you need to take in order to get one going. That one we used ancient deities or Greek gods or some ancient gods. You can see there's a lot of different applications for using graphs in the humanities, from, you know, literature to history to, you know, all different applications.
And I think, you know, there's room. The article that you mentioned about Nabokov, believed that you wrote that as a graph gist. And I think that there's room for humanities students to begin exploring writing articles in this style where they mix graph code along with their narrative expository text.
Yeah, there's a lot of different applications for it. You can publish. And then another useful thing is just to collect your research, because I think we all know, any of us who've done humanities research, you end up with a lot of post-it sticky notes throughout your books and, you know, graph pads full of notes, and you know, you're always sort of paging back through to try to figure out, you know, where did this come from? And if you take the time to encode that into a graph, then you could use it to help you know, structure your research. So it could be useful just as a research tool as well.
Well, this is terrific, Sue, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk about this. And we're asking all of our guests since we're all talking with digital experts, but we thought it'd be interesting to ask, what is your favorite analog education technology?
Well, you know, being a librarian, of course, I love books. So I'm, you know, the first person to really like to, you know, kind of get off the computer and be able to touch the pages and, you know, kind of walk away from anything that's plugged in or connected and go sit outside and listen to the birds and read that way.
Well, Sue Ellen, thank you so much for this this conversation. I think it's really interesting to hear what you're doing with graphs and how you're teaching students to think about their subjects with sort of new digital spectacles on.
Well, thanks, Cliff. I really enjoyed talking about them. As you can see, I'm, you know, kind of really, maybe I wouldn't go so far as say passionate, but I really do like working with graphs. They're really fun, interesting, lots of different uses, and I like getting people excited about them.
Okay, well, we'll talk again soon, I hope. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, hi, Michael. This is Cliff Anderson calling, and we're really glad to have you as a guest on our podcast. We're really excited to talk about Neo4j and its uses in educational technology. So maybe we could just start by having you introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about your role at the company.
Yeah, Cliff, happy to be on the show. I'm really excited to talk to you. I've been with Neo4j and New Technology, the company, for a while. So I joined in 2010 when we were still 10 people, and now it's been grown to almost 140. And I've, in all this time, I had a lot of different roles, but mostly I'm taking care of people using Neo4j. So I'm calling myself caretaker general of the Neo4j community, which is kind of, I think, describes nicely that I'm using my time to help people be happy and successful with Neo4j, and doing that with a lot of different means, from articles and blog posts and books to conference talks, meetups, events, one-to-ones, hands-on support on Stack Overflow and other places, and also giving people ideas. I'm really good at creating tons of ideas and then, you know, just spreading them out and exciting people for what's possible with this kind of technology. So in general, I'm kind of jack of all trades at the company. Do a lot of connecting of people inside and outside of the company. I think that's very important. If you have such a big field as information technology, that you kind of bring the right people together, because I think between interested parties, there can really great projects emerge.
So maybe you could give us your sort of elevator pitch for what is Neo4j, just for those who haven't heard about it yet.
I'll do that. So Neo4j is a database, like other databases as well. It's meant to manage and store and process data and make it possible to create this data. But unlike other databases, it focuses on connected information. So as you probably know, there's no such thing as disconnected information in the real world. So everything is connected with everything else, more or less. And many other databases are not really good at handling this connectiveness of data. And Neo4j was built kind of from the ground up to do this in a really efficient manner, to store, handle, and make the data available quickly and efficiently as soon as it has a lot of connections. So if you experience a lot of problems in other databases, for instance, to get really differently structured data into the database and then quickly out again, especially if you have like queries or questions that involve joining together many, many tables, then Neo4j could be a tool for you. And in general, also the model that Neo4j employs, the graph model, which is just kind of connected entities, so entities connected by relationships, is such a suitable and versatile model that you can use it for almost any kind of domain. So from things like cancer research to managing curriculums to recommendation engines to routing to even something like logistics and package management and many others as well. So it's actually not limited by the technology, just rather by your imagination and the problems that you want to solve.
One of the things I love about the way that Neo4j talks about data modeling is that it can capture your whiteboard sketches, so that when you're thinking about a domain and you start putting up circles and drawing arrows, that more or less you can take that model and encode it directly in Neo4j.
Yeah, that's true. This whiteboard friendliness is a really big advantage of the technology, because with other databases you have the problem that at a certain point, only developers can work with the database and handle the data. But what we try to do is to keep everyone who's involved in the project in the loop all the time. So from people that come from the business side to people that are users. And because this whiteboard model is so natural to humans, we start to doodle on whiteboards or blackboards as soon as we discuss any kind of topic. It's really nice to see that people can always get along, even if the data is stored in a transactional database like Neo4j, they still see the circles and arrows all the time and can reason about it and can, you know, spot issues or find new connections and so on. And the other thing that we also try to do is not just do it like on the whiteboard level and on the visualization level, but also with our query language Cypher, we try to kind of take this whiteboard model and the kind of patterns that you draw on the whiteboard and turn them into a textual query language. And what we did there is actually to use ASCII art to represent these two-dimensional drawings in a kind of one-dimensional text that works actually pretty well. So what we actually do is we surround entities or nodes, how we call them, in round parentheses. So they kind of form a circle visually, and then use something like dash dash greater than or dash dash less than to indicate the arrows. And so you can easily, if you look at a query in Cypher, still see the original patterns that you were looking at or talking about. So for instance, if you're asking for an author who authored a book, which had characters appearing in the book, which then will in certain scenes, for instance, and you have this kind of pattern that you would usually draw on a whiteboard, you kind of more or less draw it in text. And because that's so kind of visual and also efficient, some people even say it's more expressive than English in kind of declaring these connected patterns of information that you then let the database figure out how to get them quickly back to you and aggregate and project information that you collect while searching for these patterns in the data.
So you described Cypher, which I think is one of the real joys of Neo4j. I think you've done a wonderful job of developing that language. And, you know, we've had the experience here at Vanderbilt of using Cypher in workshops and in the classroom and on student projects. And one of the things that we find is that, as you say, students really take to it because it does have a kind of visual component that models the types of graphs they're building. And the other thing that you've done that I think has been terrific for a teaching tool is this concept of a graph gist. Do you want to say a little bit about what graph gists are?
Yeah, definitely. I'd like to. So in general, I think Neo4j or the people at Neo4j from the very beginning spend a lot of time and effort on documentation. So making it as easy as possible for people to get started with Neo4j, but also to have documentation about, you know, common graph models or typical patterns that you use a graph for. And when we were looking into that to bring it to a broader audience, it actually turned out that with Cypher, we had the ability to kind of take regular text files. So you have like headers, you have prose, you have images, you have tables, and you can intersperse that with kind of code sections that either create data or query data. And then we can take one of these text files, which is just a regular text file that you can store on your computer, on Dropbox, in a version control like GitHub, and so on. and then take this text file, extract the cipher statements, run them against a temporary Neo4j database, and then render the graph visualizations or the table results that come back from these queries. So you kind of have a live document that represents your like your ideas that you describe in prose or formulas or other visuals, and you have within that document you have exactly the same queries that create the graph data and query the graph data. So you have a live document of what you want to do, and then also demonstrating how you want to do that. And over the years, we had several challenges for people to produce these graphs, and also a lot of people actually creating them on their own. And so in total, we have now a collection of, I think, almost 300 of them, a lot across a lot of different categories. So from things like humanities to healthcare to logistics to recommendations to storytelling. And if you want to see some of them, you can go to neo4j.com/graphs, and then you can find a rich collection of these really interesting documents. And as an author, you can also run this locally. So if you want to keep your data inside your company or so, then you can also say, okay, I just run this locally. And the use for students is actually quite interesting because I'm also doing classroom lectures sometimes, either directly or remotely. And we even use GraphQS as homework assignments for students. So because in the lecture, they learn kind of about graphs in Neo4j and Cypher. And then we give them like an GraphQS template that they can then put in a model that they like, either something that they are interested in, a hobby or a project they've been working on, and just, you know, create a little bit of data, write one or two queries, and then hand this in as a homework assignment to the professor. And so far, the professors and the students that we did it with really liked the idea, and we got some really interesting content out of that. So because if people get started once and they really care about the subject, then they go to very great lengths and depths to create something that's really truly amazing. And for us, it's always astounding kind of the variety of things that people use Neo4j and the graph model for. So it's a kind of really exciting time. Every day you learn something new, how someone used this technology. And that makes it really a lot of fun to work with the people in the Neo4j community as well.
Well, and we'll put the link to the GraphQS in our show notes, but it is really a wonderful collection, especially if you're thinking about a domain that you might like to model to see how others have done it. I love the idea of using it for homework. We'll have to try that here. One of the other things that you've done that I think has been really great for helping people to get started is that you've built in a visualization engine into Neo4j so that it's not just coming out as tabular data, but it's actually also got a graphical representation from your queries.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's kind of ties to what I said before, that we want to keep this kind of rich whiteboard visualization of your domain, and not just on the whiteboard and in the query language, but also in the output that you get back from your database. And as actually in the database, it's stored the data is stored as nodes and relationships anyway. Kind of putting them on the screen again is just a little step, but very, very useful, because many people just have to take this visual cue and have a much easier time to work with the data if they can see it. And even if you can't visualize the whole graph, because many graphs go into the like billions of nodes, if you have kind of real world production data, but you can always visualize a sample or kind of a small part of that and kind of explain something, and also kind of navigate visually. You can kind of double click on nodes and then they expand with their neighborhood and so on. I think this aspect is really important. And there are many other tools and library that people also use to kind of integrate these kinds of visualizations into their own projects, which makes it really easy for them to also have within their own application a graph visualization that allows them to, you know, bring home the point of kind of the richness of the domain, which is kind of, if you put it in table, it's just lost, right? Because in tables, you just have columns and numbers and you actually don't see the forest for the trees anymore. And so I think the graph visualization is a really important aspect, as you said, to make the data accessible again for people. And
well, if you were to come here to Vanderbilt, you'd see that we've actually put several on display in our exhibits. So the students who have worked on these have been very proud of the visualizations they've produced. And again, you know, I think one of the things is it's open. You can add something like D3JS to do more complicated visualizations, but you've made it very easy for people without a programming background to get started. And then when they need to scale up and do something different, they can do that.
Yeah, that's true. So you've probably heard of the Panama Papers investigation this year, and the ICIJ, the Investigative Journalists Consortium, also used Neo4j as the underlying technology to kind of connect all the different bits of pieces of information. And for them, they had kind of this this quote that they said, it's like magic, right? So you just put the data in there and suddenly it's available as a connected network of information that you can see, and you can see connections between people and events and companies and so on. And as soon as you kind of start to add new connections, then new patterns emerge. And so you can have, for instance, two or three of the 400 journalists that work on the data add new connections, and suddenly a new story emerges for a third journalist, right? And having this available for everyone is kind of really powerful, because then you can not just take the typical kind of business applications, but you can also do so much more. So there are projects like thecodex.net, which uses Renaissance letters from like Da Vinci and Michelangelo from Italy to kind of draw a full picture with timeline and places and events out of the kind of Renaissance, right? And or if you take other data sources like information from about authors, like you did at Vanderbilt, kind of the work of an author, or if you take full libraries, for instance, and cross-reference the works in the library, then I think all this information is so much more accessible than it's if it is just in an index or in a tabular database, I think.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful that you've also made that available as a Docker image, so that people who want to explore that data easily can get started really quickly. I was at a meetup in San Francisco where they were sort of helping people hands-on to get that Docker image up and running. So again, it's a nice, you know, you've done a great job just packaging this so that people can easily get started with queries and exploring without a lot of preliminary setup. So again, thanks, Michael, for talking with us. And as we ask all our guests, what would you consider your favorite analog technology?
That's a really interesting question. So I'm a big fan of Da Vinci. Actually, I was in a really good exhibition just a few weeks back, and I think looking at all the things he invented and built just with simple mechanics, I think that's my favorite technology, to say so. You know, from his flying machines to all the levers and pulls and all the things that made work so much easier for people, I think that's the thing that I really like most, and kind of to see what's possible if you kind of just smart about things and not just use brute force.
Yeah, that's a wonderful answer. I love those notebooks too. So, well, we really appreciate the time you've taken with us, and we really appreciate everything that you've done at Neo4j to help students get started with thinking about graphs and databases, and we look forward to seeing exciting things to come. So thanks so much again.
Yeah. And for everyone who is able to, I invite everyone to come to our conference in San Francisco, to GraphConnect. It's on October 13th.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thanks again, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Michael Hummer of Neo Technology, and earlier, Sue Ellen Stringer High, a librarian here at Vanderbilt University. You can read more about both of our guests by following the links in the show notes, which include a link to the Getting Started with GraphGists tutorial that Sue Ellen mentioned. Thanks to Cliff Anderson, Director of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt University Library, for those interviews. You've been listening to Leading Lines, a podcast on educational technology from Vanderbilt University. The podcast is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. You can find past episodes on our website, leadinglinespod.com, and you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @leadinglinespod. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.